AM friends, you are now listening to the Degen Aussie Apes, bringing you another weekly session, all things crypto and NFTs. Let's go.
It's the money.
GM. What's happening, guys?
GM
too, sir.
Guys, for everyone listening, I mean, we're super, super excited today. You know, AI has been a massive trend at the moment. Everyone's going crazy about AI. And today we are super excited to have Raymond Sun. I mean, I'm talking lawyer, programmer, content creator, all things AI. Raymond, man, thanks for coming into the Degen Aussie Apes studio.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me. Super pumped. I love the studio.
Thanks, oh, yeah. Man. It's welcome, man. Thanks so much for coming on down and making the time to chat all things Raymond Sun, AI, K-pop.
Yeah.
I mean, you're doing it all, bro.
Yeah, definitely. Very keen to talk about it. Like, AI is my passion. So, very happy to just talk hours and hours about it. Yeah.
So, how about you take us back to the beginning, your story?
Yeah.
How did you get into AI?
Yeah, well, okay. So, I guess it all started with Iron Man as a kid. Even before the Marvel movies came out, there was the anime version of Iron Man and the comic version of Iron Man. And Iron Man, as we all know, has this cool AI system called Jarvis. Mm. While most of my friends were fascinated about the Iron Man suits, I was more into the Jarvis system. Like, imagine having a robot assistant just doing everything for you on your command.
What a dream.
Yeah, I was so obsessed with that Jarvis system since I was like 6 years old. And I've always wanted to have some sort of robot friend or some AI assistant.
And is that why you now have Sunday?
That was the eventual manifestation. Yeah.
Wow. Sorry to interrupt. Please continue. Yeah, but no. You've done it. You've actually achieved what your dream was.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And so also anything to do with robotics. So the movie Robots, Astro Boy, Half Robot. Anything robots and AI was always my thing. And I've also liked the law side as well. So I can talk about my law journey as well. Eventually, I went into high school. So I went to Sydney Technical High School, which had a strong technology focus. And so we got to do subjects on woodwork, metalwork, and also ICT, like computer programming. And so I made some really cool friends who were also into computers. And I was also at the age where we played a lot of games, video games, Call of Duty, Pokemon. Played so many games, our parents started getting concerned. You should stop playing games, do something more productive in your life. And so my friends and I started, why not make our own games? Software called Game Maker Studio.
I've used that before.
Yeah, I've used it. So it's a very user-friendly drag and drop interface to build your games. And that's when I actually appreciated the power of mathematics. You learn all this math in these classes, XY coordinates, parabolas. Why didn't you learn that until you start making games? Then that's when it's powerful. Like, to throw a boomerang, you have to create the path of the boomerang, maths. To create like how the ball falls on the ground and bounces, gravity, or maths. So that's maybe that got me seriously into like STEM and just appreciating how computers work. So did some game making throughout high school. Then after high school, we had to make our uni choices. So most of my friends decided to do computer science. I wanted to do law. The reason why I chose law is because I'm also very interested in the social side of things, justice, rights and obligations. And there have been some times where I've been like cheated, taken advantage of, and I want to make sure that when I grow up, I know what rights I have, how to express my rights, how to articulate arguments so that I can just conduct myself more properly. And just one example, just to give some context, is I play a lot of chess back in high school, and we play these team chess competitions. We'll compete against other schools. And there was this one year where it was us against this another school, and whoever will win that round will go into the grand final. And there was four people per team. You needed just the majority wins, then you go through the two finals. And so we got to the point where it was two versus two. So two wins from their school, two wins from our school. The rule was that the captain of the team, if they win their game, then in the tiebreak, that their team will go to the finals. But I didn't know that rule. And so the other school, they noticed that I wasn't aware of that rule. And so they took advantage of that and said, let's have a rematch the next time. And they kept doing that for every tiebreak until they won like 3-1. Yeah. And that's when I realized, wow, knowing the rules, knowing how to articulate that, and so they went on to win the finals. And I only realized that in retrospect, oh, we could have won the first time when it was just a tiebreak. I like doing law, the puzzles, social puzzles and writing challenges.
So all your friends went into computer science, computer engineering, and
that's
you
right.
chose law.
I chose cool. law. But I'm still close. I'm still very close with my friends. And when we caught up after high school days, they'll just talk about the assignments they did, how they would learn actual coding, building cool apps. And I was like, damn, I really want to do that. And then I just thought back to all the Iron Man stuff I wanted to build. And I also wanted to be able to pitch into those conversations. I don't want to be like the odd one out, not be able to talk about what Python is. And so that motivated me to learn code. Started learning Java, Python. It was a very hard, difficult at first, because as a law student, you're very into languages, humanities, the words. And so when you go into something that's like very
numbers
and technical, even though I enjoyed maths, the way of thinking is still very different. But yeah, that initial hurdle was hard. But once I got through, once I understood how code works, then it was magical. I could build anything I want. And I started from building simple calculators from scratch to simple websites to flash games in code. And I started moving to more serious applications. So one of my first ever serious application was building a tool for my firm, the current place I work at. Lots of documents to go through. I built an algorithm that could just automate the process and extract data from documents. And that was my first ever, I guess, commercially important or commercially useful tool. Mm. And that got me like thinking, wow, like coding is actually such a powerful skill as long as you know how to apply to solve a problem. And around that time, that's where I started to really manifest my love for AI. I finally now have the skills and knowledge to do something AI. So back to the drawing board, back to YouTube tutorials, learning what AI is from a technical perspective, the basics, from simple regression to...
I love how you use the pen and paper in your videos.
Yeah, I think
that's a very authentic touch.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so when I learn things, I try to simplify into concepts and be able to explain it to my mom and dad. Mm. So that's the way I learn. Yeah, so from simple regression all the way to neural networks. But you can't just learn things. You can watch a bunch of tutorials but not apply that knowledge to something. You have to just take that first step and build something.
Knowledge is only power when you actually use it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Definitely. In terms of your coding journey, like when did you actually start learning to code? Because as with myself, you know, I didn't come from a technical background, so I just started from YouTube as most people do. Free online courses, Udemy, like there's all these resources out there. When did your journey begin?
First year uni during the summer break. It was in uni, you have a 3-month holiday break. Mm. I was dead bored. Like the first week I went to the beach and had fun. But after that, I was like, what do I want to do with these 3 months of free time? It's always about the Iron Man dream. Mm. And I was like, why not try actually go close towards that dream? And so that's when I started.
Was Siri a thing at the time? Was Siri or...
Yeah, Siri was already a thing at the time. And I just want to learn how it actually works. It's just so curious about it. And so, yeah, just how like you started, like John, just YouTube. Just literally type in JavaScript tutorial, watch a 4-hour video done by someone. And yeah, just take notes and just learn how they build games. Mm-hmm. I think the most effective learning strategy was I would follow a tutorial on someone building a game. I'll follow that step by step. Then I'll rewatch a tutorial and try build it again, but try to minimize the amount of time I'll spend watching the video. And I'll keep repeating that until I could rebuild the game without having to look at the video. Right. And that really forced me not to rote learn code, but to actually understand the concepts. I remember like I did that process for 5 times. Let's say the first time I got it, I finally understood what variables are. The second time I did it, I started to understand what functions did. And then the third time I started to understand what classes and object-oriented programming was. So that really helped consolidate the basics. Mm. And once I understood the basics, nothing can take that away from me. You can just start learning new things.
That's the foundation you build everything
foundations. On. It's just like martial arts, sport. The foundations matter so much. Mm. And so when it came to AI, it's really just the same thing, but just applied in a different way. Mm. And that's how I was able to pick up AI quite naturally once you got the basics down.
So would you say in order to learn AI, you need to have a very strong fundamental understanding of object-oriented programming and just programming in general?
I think it helps because you could learn AI immediately, but it'll be mostly rote learning. You'll be just learning this formula, why this function works. Like you won't really understand why it happened, which means you'll be limited in terms of building apps. You won't have the ability to really customize an existing open source solution because you don't really understand the basics. Mm. But once you do, then when you watch a tutorial, even if they don't cover it in detail, you can still kind of work out why that function exists. But that's not to deter anyone who wants to actually learn AI. You can still go on YouTube, type in machine learning tutorials, but I think you have a more smooth journey if you know the basics. Yeah.
And in terms of kind of, you know, you mentioned the first kind of commercial app that you build. What did you go on to build then? Is your source like open code? Is it on your GitHub for anyone to see? Like
after that first ever project, COVID struck and it was locked down. And for those who don't know, I also one of my other hobbies is dancing. I dance in dance crews and I go to dance classes regularly. And it's great. It's fun exercise. But when lockdown happened, no more dance classes, no more hangouts. And so what do? You learn dance from YouTube tutorials, but it's not the same, man. There's no teacher to correct you on your posture and your form. And so I just thought, why not just have a virtual assistant or AI that can help improve my dance? So it was like a very organic moment, right? It wasn't something that I wanted to do for my resume. It was like a real life personal problem that I wanted to solve. And I just thought, why not take this up? And I was also already learning some AI basics already. So why not make it a challenge and build an AI like dance assistant? And so that's why I got into learning computer vision, convolutional neural networks, pose estimation, starting from Wikipedia searches to Google searches, just slowly read, experimenting with different open source libraries until you put everything together. And I guess throughout the journey, I also vlogged my process because I was also very into video making vlogs. I vlogged my process, and once I had my first prototype, the prototype was you take a video of a dancer, and you also film yourself doing a dance to the same choreography. And you basically upload both videos to the app, and it will analyze both videos and see how similar you dance compared to the original dancers. And it will return that in a percentage. For example, you're 80% similar. And it also return a bunch of screenshots that tell you where you kind of deviated. So at frame 36, your arm was at that angle where it should have been at that angle.
That's amazing, man.
it wasn't released to the public because at that time I still didn't really know how to release an app like that. Mm. I posted on YouTube and I put on Reddit, Facebook, and quite a big community just thought it was really cool. And then one person commented, why not apply this to actual professional dancers? So instead of judging yourself, why don't you try evaluate actual professional dancers? And I was thinking, okay, what type of dancers? And I thought, K-pop was, especially with BTS going on back then, like massive. And the dance practice videos are like hype.
I cannot believe that you went through the effort of breaking down by group size. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey. Oh my gosh.
K-pop bands have, I don't know, 3 to 6. You had a different segment for them. I was surprised there's K-pop because I don't know much about K-pop. And I was going to ask you how the K-pop scene is in Sydney compared to Melbourne. I don't know.
Yeah, well, in the Western world, K-pop back then was right now it's quite hype and mainstream. But back then, it was still quite underrated. Mm. In Asia, though, it's the biggest thing in Asia, right?
Yeah. When I was traveling, everywhere you go, like in a bar or whatever, like they have it on the screen, and there's even karaoke, and like it's a full scene.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's so massive over there.
And one more question on that. So what's M-pop?
M-pop is Mandopop. So it's basically, it's like similar vibe, but in China, and China, Mandarin speaking populations.
Because I saw one of your things on the video go, oh, this is technically M-pop. Yeah. And I thought to myself, what's M-pop? Yeah, I better ask you on the podcast.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah, the fans over there get very particular about these sort of details.
Hey, Shaheen, do we have any listeners in Korea?
Korea, I think we do, actually. Fans out there, I mean, we've graced, what, now 50 or so?
Poland was last week.
Poland, I mean, gosh, Israel. I mean, there's been a lot.
So if there's any K-pop fans out there, you better check out Mr. Ray here.
Yeah.
We'll be putting all the channels up, man. Sweet. All the links will be there. Techie Ray, all going to be there.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm just so blown away because obviously, like as everyone knows, I mean, AI is really on the forefront. And with your app that you made, was it a Japanese game show?
It got to a point where my channel somehow became like the authoritative source on like K-pop dance synchronization. Such a niche topic. But whenever people would try to like analyze K-pop dance, then it was just a very subjective view. But now my channel became like the OG source. Like this video said that they got X percent. That's it. And
did you have any of the bands reach out to you? Go.
Oh yeah, that. So, like, not personally reach out to me, but they've reacted to my videos. So, like, for those who don't know, K-pop bands, they have very strong engagement with their fans. So they do live streams. They like to watch content that their fans recommended. And one of the big groups, like Seventeen, in their live stream, they reacted to one of my videos and they thought it was really cool because they're famous for being super synchronized in the K-pop scene. So that's their thing, right? And my program actually validated them as being the top synchronized group. And so that was a really cool moment. So you had these small moments where the actual K-pop fans react to that. And I got to the 2-year mark where one of the Japanese entertainment companies took notice of my video, and they messaged me and they said they'll like to incorporate my algorithm or use my program in some way for the upcoming TV show. They have a boy band called JO1, which is like very big in Japan, equivalent to like a Justin Bieber of Japan, very, very big. And they have K-pop and J-pop, they have like variety shows. So these idols, they don't just sing on stage, they also do a lot of reality TV shows. And the reality TV show that they had was like a challenges type of show. So they'll get the boy band to do various challenges.
Like the Squid Game without the death.
That's a perfect description. Yeah, Squid Game without the death. And one of the upcoming episodes was on dance synchronization, because everyone in Japan loved how synchronized they were. And it was like a 1-year process where it was back and forth communications. And I was able to give a demo, have a call with them. And as the lawyer in me was also very like, I'm also very like astute and conservative about how I approach these things. I want to make sure that
They can rip you off.
Exactly. So I don't want to be that kid who got ripped off in that chess scene, right? So that's where the lawyer in me was very helpful. Made sure to I still own my algorithm, I still own my product. It was just a licensing basis. So they were licensed to use the algorithm, and they built their own interface. So that was fair game. Like I still own my thing. They needed to customize it in a way that fit the TV show, which is fair enough. And yeah, that was a 1-year process. And then they finally released the episode, and I watched the episode. So basically, the JO1 boy band, they had to learn a new dance in 5 minutes, and they just learned it on the spot. And they also had another team, like the TV host, to also do the same thing. And they would compare the hosts versus the boy band, who would dance better. And the basis for that was the actual algorithm to analyze how synchronized they were. And it was very cool. Maybe I could send the clip later.
Yeah, we'll definitely check it out.
Oh, I'd love to have a look.
But just on that note, the commercial use case for something like that in that industry.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like Formula One, for example, when sensors became a thing, you know, IoT, they put them all over the car to gather that data.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, out of your passion for dance,
you
know, there are audience there where dance is their life or their business, your algorithm was basically a great data source for them,
exactly.
Right?
In terms of your YouTube videos, because I've checked your channel and you got millions of views on some of those videos. Yeah. What was it like when that YouTube channel was blowing up? Did you expect it to reach those heights, refreshing every minute and seeing the numbers going up and getting that dopamine rush? Because very few people have experienced that going viral kind of effect.
It was overwhelming. Before one of my videos got viral, I would post like these small friendly videos, only got like 100 views, 90 views, like something they just show to your friends. I really did not expect this one will like be boosted by the YouTube algorithm. And it just comments started coming in like every second. There'll be positive comments and some constructive criticism. Like it was a very mixed emotion. And I was also, on the one hand, it was very cool to see your product, your own invention, your mind baby being like validated and recognized by the world. But it also got to the point where like, wow, like now my work is being evaluated, being judged by everyone.
What next is the question?
Yeah, what's next the question? And I don't think the fame has gotten to me. I'm still think I'm like very like, at that moment, it was like, it was a very surreal experience. And especially because YouTube, you get monetized after you get like a certain amount of views and rank. And then like when I saw the money, I was like, far out. Like that's, yeah, if I did this full time, that there's a possibility, right? And there was a certain point where I did contemplate doing a content creation type of career. But then I thought, man, like maybe like creativity thrives when you have no pressure. Maybe I could be wrong, but
we agree.
Yeah,
we agree. I hear it.
The more you force it sometimes, like, you know, if you have to show up and make content every single day, like you sometimes run out of inspiration or things to even do.
Yeah. Whereas if you live your life, the normal stuff you're doing, and then create the content, even the energy in that content is, you know, to the point and informational, and it's adding value, because at the end of the day, you're not going to get those hours in watching time if that user is not getting value. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, we're all humans and we're all learning and we want, you know, life is tough as it is, but to tune out for a short, have a laugh, it's amazing.
That's right. Exactly. So I decided just to still continue doing my day job and just making this stuff on the side. When my YouTube started growing, I started to like seriously consider like using that advantage for the good, like using my platform to spread positive messages and teaching something. Again, for more context, I'm a very big believer in living your life in a way that benefits others. So making sure you help people in this lifetime. You can be super rich or super, super wealth in some areas, but I think nothing beats the satisfaction of just helping someone and change their life.
We could tell you're a good man, Ray.
And like, before then, I was volunteering a lot in mental health, like the organization called Headspace. I'll go to high schools to do TED Talks. Mm. And really, my job was to do public speaking, motivate young kids, especially boys from like disadvantaged backgrounds who grew up in very rough environments and have like a very unclear direction in life, just to go and just to give them some light. And yeah, I've seen some audience members just lighten up of these talks, and that's really satisfying. But it's a scaling problem, right? Doing in-person speeches, you can't do much, but online content, you can do that on a massive scale. And that's when I started seriously considering using my YouTube just to like teach people or motivate people. And that's what I've been doing these days. Yeah.
Well, you're a man of many talents.
I like AI, learning. I like learning.
That's AI, like, yeah. Law, content creation, mental health. Like, how do you keep up with all of it? Like, do you focus on one particular niche at a time?
Yeah. So when people list out all the stuff that I do at the same time, sounds like I do a lot and I don't sleep. It's more of a rotation. And I don't really force myself to do everything at once. Do things that feels good to do. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I love it. And just on the topic of ChatGPT, because, you know, we've seen the AI meme coins come along. We're all degen traders, you know, and AI has really taken the world by storm. What are your thoughts on the ChatGPT craze? Like, is it well-deserved? Is it valid? Is it revolutionary? Or is it a bit overrated? Like, what are your actual thoughts on ChatGPT?
Yeah, so ChatGPT falls within the broader background of AI. Now, AI has been around for a couple decades already. The concept started since the 1950s, so it's not completely new. But what ChatGPT has changed was made it mainstream and accessible and understandable to the layperson. Before ChatGPT, many people have heard of the term AI, but didn't really appreciate or understand its true power. When ChatGPT came out, very simple interface, can answer almost any question with like such human-like flair. That really amazed a lot of people. And that, I think we've entered now a new era of AI, where AI is now mainstream, is now the hot topic. And it's not just one of those hype trends where it just lasts for like a few months and that's it. This one's going to stay forever. There are some people that say, you know, ChatGPT would like either die or whatever, but even so, even if it goes away, what the impact it has left, it's already started a new legacy. So the analogy I like to use was MySpace. When MySpace started, it was the first type of like social media company platform. And even though it's not around anymore, it started a whole new trend. Let's say if you're Facebook coming in, your Twitter going out. So it's that type of concept. So I'm sure there'll be products that will be better or faster or more accurate than ChatGPT, but what ChatGPT started is like the biggest thing. And we're now in this era of generative AI. So if I had to break down AI in different stages, when AI first came out, it was more for data analysis, statistical predictions from 1950s to like the early 2000s. Then the 2010s start to come out, and that's where the concept of neural networks really started to become popular. So Google, DeepMind, they had breakthroughs in neural network technology. Mm-hmm. And that's, so if I were to use analogies, if statistical analysis was teaching computers how to predict data, neural networks taught computers how to see things, how to listen to things, how to speak things. So to actually think with like a brain. And that created a whole booming industry. Self-driving cars, speech recognition, facial recognition, all come from neural networks. And that was the next boom in AI.
When you talk about AI, machine learning's under that umbrella for you?
Yeah. All right, yeah. So just to bring it back. So AI is more of a broad term to describe any machine that can complete, that can do tasks that normally require human intelligence. There's no official definition of AI, but that's like the most common definition. And there are different types of AI. The two broad categories are machine learning, and you also have another side category called symbiotic AI, which is basically a fancy word for if-else condition type of rule-based system AI. So if this happens, then do that. Many academics argue whether that is actually AI or not. That's why not many people talk about it. The main thing is machine learning, which takes up like 98% of AI applications.
And what I feel GPT did is it's taken that machine learning and AI, the person interacting with it, it's more human-like. That's now the difference, because you mentioned it, this has been around since the 50s. I work in software, you know, this whole virtual bot or virtual assistant, it's a lot of companies have tried to develop, not knowing that that is actually generating content. That's the big difference. Do you agree with that?
That's right. And that was like that when I was talking about the stages, like that was like the third boom. Generative AI is the third boom. It didn't really start with ChatGPT. It mostly started when OpenAI and like Stable Diffusion released their text to art generators. That was like that was like 2021 already happened. So I see that as the start of the generative AI boom. But ChatGPT took it to a whole new level.
Accessible to anyone.
Exactly. Making it accessible to anyone and also to answer any type of question, not just creating art. So that's how I see it. And now I guess we're still in the early stage of the generative AI boom, but I think it'll be the most defining type of AI that will define at least for our lifetime.
Do you think the law is keeping up with this development?
No.
You want to talk about that for a little bit?
Certain jurisdictions, certain countries have been making really good progress on that, and the two are the European Union and China, but everyone else is still relatively behind. And that makes sense because it's a very tough type of challenge to tackle. AI has a lot of issues, like a lot of challenges and ethical issues to sort through, and sometimes solving one issue create gaps in another area, and you also have to consider the commerciality of it. You don't want to stifle innovation. A lot of things to consider.
What would you say some of those challenges are? Because everyone's talking about, you know, AI replacing jobs and increasing efficiency and productivity. What are some of the downsides which people don't really consider? And let's not use the common examples like students are using it to write their essays and papers and stuff. Like, what are some real implications of AI that could be threatening?
There are five big issues which I'll go through real quickly. Number one, discrimination. So AI is just, it's just a computer system, and it's only as good as the data has been fed. If the data is biased, the output will be biased. And so one of the most infamous examples was when in 2016 the US court experimented with using AI to determine whether a defendant will get bail or not. And America, historically, most of the defendants who were refused bail were of African-American descent. And so that was the data set that was used to train the AI. And so by the time when they used the AI to assess a defendant, if they're of African-American of descent, the AI system will automatically be biased against that defendant and refuse bail altogether. And that's a very big discrimination issue. And it could be in any demographic, and any demographic is vulnerable.
All the stereotypes that we
exactly
know.
All Uber the stereotypes.
Drivers, security lines in airports, yes. You name it. There's all the use cases.
Yeah, that's right. So data bias creates AI bias. So that's number one, discrimination. It's probably the biggest one. Number two is privacy. So data can involve personal information. Privacy, if you misuse that data, you breach privacy obligations. And especially, again, another example, when Facebook used user data, gave it to Cambridge Analytica to use for political campaign advertisements, users did not consent to that. And Facebook eventually breached a lot of laws and paid a huge fines. That's not nice, right? So privacy is a big one. Number three, intellectual property. This one's mostly relevant in generative AI, especially if you use AI to create written content or art. Who owns the IP in the output? Still, there's no clear answer. The world is trying to scramble for an answer, but we might have some clarity in the next few months because there are currently three court cases in America that decided on that situation. Two of them are around AI-generated art, and the third one is around AI-generated code, and they're all evaluating who owns the rights in the output. I still don't know what the answer is, but I'll keep
That's
you guys updated.
One.
Yeah, I'll keep you guys updated when that outcome comes out. So IP is number three. Number four is accountability. Who's responsible when AI goes wrong? Laws haven't really created a clear standard for that. For now, many countries are relying on a specific issue to kind of catch you. So for example, if you use an AI system and you breach a privacy law, you'll be captured under privacy regulation and liability will be determined under that. Or if you breach a tax law or consumer law, you'll be regulated under those specific laws. But not many jurisdictions have an AI regulation that kind of determines what happens when just AI goes wrong by default. Europe is the one that's kind of leading this, and also China.
And what's number five?
Number five is, let me think. So
that's okay. But which one of those relates to censorship, you think? Because I think the last one you mentioned there, which is liability, if that's going to be the trapdoor that lets censorship in, because how are you going to, whoever we're going to want to cover that is going to say, well, we need to actually own the data and do the things, basically do whatever we want with it, right?
So that's the reason why AI is so tough to regulate. You have these valid arguments on every side. So it's really just trying to find a balance, a compromise. And the compromise and balance depends on a particular country's economical, philosophical, and political values. So you have certain countries like China, which value the community safety more than the individual rights. So that's how they've tailored their regulations. While Europe is more individual-centric, consumer protection. And so they've made them more pro-consumer and more restricted on businesses. So that's the balance that countries are trying to find. And I remember the fifth one, the number five is explainability and transparency. AI, you can write the code for it, but how it actually evaluates the data to create the output, no one knows for now. No one knows at this stage. Like, even the engineers themselves don't really know how an AI makes a decision. And this is really important because let's say an AI determined whether you got a speeding ticket or not. And let's just say you clearly know the AI was wrong. But how do you then challenge that? Because in the basis of like every like common law system, if you want to challenge a decision, you have to be able to explain why. And to explain why, you have to be able to identify the flaw in the decision-making process. If you don't know how the AI operates, how do you then challenge a decision? So that's a very huge implication for just human rights if you can't explain how AI works.
So back to your point, yeah. OpenAI is the answer. You'd hope the people who wrote ChatGPT know the answer to the and can provide transparency. But now you hear, did everybody see, Microsoft now is going to be 51% owner, 49% owner of OpenAI, which means only they will know how AI, you know, ChatGPT is actually working. That concerns me.
We don't know like of how GPT works. You only know to the extent of how it's trained, but you actually don't know how an AI makes a decision is that it takes the data and that data passes through a network of like nodes and each node is characterized by a certain weight. Like a random number. And these weightings are unknown. You don't know what these weightings are. And even if you do know what these weightings are, they're just numbers to a human. A human can't really understand what these numbers are. But these weightings are what determine whether a certain factor or attribute contributes to a certain decision. So just to give a really simple example, how do you predict it will be raining tomorrow? You look at the humidity, you look at whether there are clouds, the temperature, the location. And each of these factors has a certain weighting. So obviously, humidity will have a higher importance than, let's say, compared to how many clouds there are in the sky, right? Mm-hmm. Each factor has a particular weighting. And the accurate, powerful AI, what they do is that they just have really bespoke, well-adjusted weightings on how they interpret data. So it's really just the weightings. But no one knows how they came about to those particular weightings. And so you can build an AI system from scratch. But ultimately, these weightings are automatically run by an AI. That's the whole deal. If you want an AI to self-learn, you need to give it that freedom to not adjust its weights. I'm not in OpenAI or Microsoft, but given the technology and how it works, I doubt if the engines can fully explain how it makes a certain decision.
Yeah, because the pre-training is probably more where the data that you feed it. That's back right. to your original comment.
Yeah.
So there's that part about determining the randomness of those nodes.
Yeah.
But then the pre-training you give it, that's basically, you know, the humans can actually try and influence it by giving it the data set.
Yeah, that's the extent of knowledge. Yeah.
I was going to ask, do you feel that Pandora's box has now been opened?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we're looking at things like deep fakes at the moment going around, which is quite scary. Where are we going to be in 5 years? In regards, you were saying to regulations, we're far behind. Do we need the regulation in now before? But we've opened the box. It's only going to get better and faster. I mean, what's your thoughts on that? Have we unleashed the beast?
My thinking is AI is just a piece of technology. It's neither inherently good or bad. It's neutral. What makes it good is how people use it. And what makes it bad is, again, how people use it. So the AI problem that we often see is really a human problem, a process problem. The aim of regulation is to not so much regulate technology. Of course, for example, nuclear weapons, you have to regulate the technology. That's inherently
destructive. If it's a hazard, it's a different class, yeah.
But if we talk about just AI in general, just neural networks in general, then it's all about how people use it. See, it's all about regulating conduct. So the stuff around deep fakes, false information, that stuff is very serious. It's wrong to go about trying to restrict and ban technologies because everyone can innovate and find loopholes around it. It's about trying to regulate the conduct. And also, regulation is one thing. There's also the social, cultural aspect to do that. You have to educate people, train people, develop that ethical morality and integrity to use AI properly. Mm. And that's where the whole concept of responsible AI comes in. That's the long-term solution. You can have regulations that cover everything.
That's assuming they get it right.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. It's the people. You need to have people to respect the law and to be able to use AI responsibly. And that's probably the long-term challenge, education piece. Yeah.
The issue is who decides all this, like the algorithm, for example, and you know if it's going to be regulated and things like that. Like at the end of the day, when you think of it, AI is just going to be end up being centralized anyway. Just like Google became censored, centralized, and
How long do you think?
Look, I think it'll be a good tool. I completely agree with you. It's like an advanced version of Google search. That's the way I look at it. But for you to ask a real personal questions, because I know people are going to use it for that, real personal questions, and really take it in and start to believe certain ideas based on what AI tells you, I think that's when you're going to see it's going to be an issue in society. Mm. That's what I feel.
Yeah, good point. So were you asking who makes the rules?
So I know like ChatGPT, for example, in I think it was 2017, they changed the algorithm, and it just, who decides how the algorithm's designed or how it's regulated or what rules to use, or, you know.
So this really depends on the country. Let's just talk about Australia, okay? So yeah. Australia's system is quite democratic, right? And you have different stakeholders applying different rules. So you have the broad framework, the broad regulation that basically tells you do not make AI systems that do X, Y, Z federal level. And also make sure you consider these principles when building AI systems. Right now, Australia doesn't have a mandatory legislation on it. The best we've got is an ethics system, the 8 AI ethics principles, which are fairness, privacy, accountability, etc. So you have the broad framework to kind of drive general behavior. And it comes down to what I think is particular bespoke legislation that enforce these values. So for example, our privacy laws could be updated to reflect certain ethic principles. So if you're building AI systems that handle lots of privacy or personal information, you've got to take into account these principles. And so you have to tailor your algorithm to respect that. Likewise for consumer protection and IP. That's like your federal legislation level. Then you go into like the industries. AI is a very versatile tool, and different industries use it for different purposes. So you can't just have like a broad level brush regulation that does everything. You got to also leave it to businesses and industries to regulate for themselves. So that's where I think industry standards comes in. Let's say the healthcare industry will have very strict restrictions or rules around how algorithms handle like
medical data,
right? Whereas let's say the finance industry care more about how the algorithm will impact on like the finances and personal consumers. So different industries will have different emphasis on what needs to be protected more and what can be like more relaxed. So it will come down to industries, and each industry will have like its own like representative body, like a union or something that kind of does all that stuff. And then it will be up to the people within that industry to help inform on those rules. So some consultation process, going to the public, asking submissions. So it'll be that's how Australia makes rules, like very democratic, getting people's like input into things. Some other countries were more authoritative. The state just implements the rules. There's good and bad, right? The good thing about the democratic process is that people's views are taken into account, but it takes a long time. And it's subject to government change, right? If they lose election, then all the work's just gone.
Restart. Go back to the drawing board. Go back to discoveries from the beginning. Exactly. Restart the framework from step one.
That's right.
Yeah.
Whereas in the more authoritative governments, maybe public views, consensus is not that important, but they get the rules from day one and that's it. And you make that huge progress. But it could be wrong, it could be right.
What are your thoughts on open source AI?
Open source, it's not just an AI thing, just software in general. You don't have to have AI to have these issues. It can just be any other type of software that does something that affects people's livelihoods. So there's nothing wrong about, like tech is neutral, it's how people use it. So the question of open source, I don't really see as that being much of the main focus. It's all about what people use that open source for. You can make everything open source. Like you can have the most destructive AI open source, or you can have the most productive AI being open sourced. It's more about regulations on how people access and use it. Super destructive AI should not be open source for obvious reasons. Beyond extremes, right? Just the stuff in the middle, then it's all just about people conduct. Mm-hmm. And that's where, again, education comes in.
I want to ask you, I know we touched on it a little bit before, Oxtract, which is the Chrome extension that extracts relevant definitions and cross-references as you review Commonwealth legislation on the Federal Register. I mean, that when I read that you had created something like that really blew my mind, because you know, my sister works for a stockbroking company in compliance and things like that. I thought of her straight away. Where did that idea sort of come from? Did you see there was something missing? Did you see, hold on a second, with my background with programming and all these types of things, I can create something like this? And is there a level of adoption being used?
As with everything I build, it's all comes from solving my personal problems first. Because inventions blow up if they actually solve problems and give value to people. So if it solves your problem, then I'm sure it'll solve other people's problems. So that's how I go about building things. I don't do it for like chasing money or... Yeah, that particular example, I was just, you know, working late at night, reviewing legislation. All our federal legislation is hosted on this website and it can get very glitchy, especially when reviewing super long legislation that's like 500 pages long. How legislation is written is it references certain definitions and they could also refer to other paragraphs, which means you have to scroll back and forth. And it's these small things add up at late nights and when you're stressed and you're under time pressure, and it's quite draining. And I know I'm not the only one who feels that way, but it's one of those problems where it's big enough to annoy you, but not too big that people want to just dare to
do it in your own time.
Exactly. Mm. And so I just thought I had enough. I want to build something that solves that problem, and I just built it. And so whenever you review legislation, whenever you click on a clause, all the relevant definitions and cross references are just displayed on the side.
Oh,
it's such a simple, it blew my mind. No one has thought of that before. Or maybe they've thought of it, but they just didn't know how to build it. Mm. Again, I work in the legal industry, so it's quite rare for people to kind of think technically and actually take action to do it. I just built it, and when it came out, like lots of people, not just within people within my firm, just everywhere across the Australian law industry. So that's my philosophy, is if you help people, if you save time for people, you're basically saving their life. Because our life is measured in minutes. Every minute we're going through, we're getting closer to the end, right? So you save someone's time, it's just as powerful as saving someone's life in the hospital or the courtroom or whatever. So that's my philosophy, man. It's just saving people's phenomenal. Time. For me, like my brain is always thinking about problem solving. I'm always problem solving, like subconsciously. When I see that, I realize it's a pattern in how legislation is set out.
That's your matrix. That's how you see the world. Optimization opportunity here, right. There. No.
Yeah, it's about trying to like work smart.
Smarter, not harder.
Yes, exactly.
Just on that topic though. Yeah. So, you know, obviously this is a crypto podcast and we've delved a lot into AI and I've absolutely been loving it. What do you think has been a greater innovation? Do you think it's been blockchain or AI? Like, what do you think will have a bigger impact on humanity?
I think definitely both. I can't really measure the impact. I can't compare the impact because they're impacting different things. The blockchain technology, it goes towards the idea of decentralization. And decentralization is fundamentally going towards how people interact with one another and how people interact with the world. Without the concept of removing intermediaries and the concept of people not having to like fully trust each other nor to just do simple transactions between each other, that has a very disruptive impact in any industry that involves a transfer of value. Transfer money, transfer items, whatever. Anything that involves a transaction, blockchain will disrupt that. That's big, right? AI, it's a very versatile technology. It can be for creating content, can be for making better decisions. Ultimately, I think AI is more about, the impact will be about decision-making. So no matter how advanced AI becomes, ultimately, I think it'll be a tool that will either save time or help you make decisions. Blockchain is about transactions. AI is about decision-making and like efficiency. Or blockchain is also about efficiency too. So maybe just compare decision-making versus transactions. So different field, different matrix of impact.
Different skills required.
Different skills required. So I think both are equally important. Blockchain, there are some elements which are just hype and, you know, just a fad. While other bits are like, this is actually really good. Same with AI. There's both good and bad and like overhyped and underhyped. So, and in terms of the convergence, it's simple. Anything that involves transactions and decision-making, boom, that's where AI and blockchain will just marry together. That's it. That's how I think of things. It's pretty simple.
It is actually when you think of it that way.
Yeah.
I love it. I love all of it. The philosophy, changing lives. I mean, some of the best businesses you look in history were born for one reason, and that was through a frustration where you get frustrated to a point where you're like, you know what? I have the skill set and I'm going to do something about it. Excited to see your journey. I mean, there's still so much more that you do. You're a part of the Data Science and AI Association of Australia, which I didn't even know existed until I was scrolling through your LinkedIn, and you're a content administrator there. How is the association? I mean, I'd love to know a bit about that.
Yeah. So I joined not too long ago. Actually, the guys who are behind it, like Mark Monfort and Arturo, they run the DeFi Association.
Oh,
So that's what
Captain D5.
Is that Captain D5?
Lovely.
Yeah, so I met them through those events, and then they also have an interest in AI. So they also brought me along to those the Adala Science and AI events. And then I love sharing knowledge on, especially the regulatory front. I don't think there are many people who are deep in both the tech and law. And so I was able to just, I guess, make use of my background to just teach people. And yeah, they found that very useful. And I guess that's how I'll be able to produce content on behalf of the association and just help educating people. Yeah, it's all volunteer stuff, but I find meaning in this sort of stuff. It was like AI is going to become one of those things where everyone will just have to be familiar with. Like your grandkids, your kids, we learn this in school one day. It'll be a part of everyday life. You have to just know the basics, man. Just good to get a head start. And just, I think when social media launched and when the market was saturated with content, I think many people have just become more like just believe in what they see. I think maybe back then people would be more critical. With AI, there's even less of a need to kind of like produce content, put in effort, which in turn increases the need to be able to like not take everything at face value. So I think there's also going to be an evolution in humanity. We'll become more of a critical thinker. I think that's like going to be the next stage in how we evolve.
Do you feel like what's actually happening is parts of people's brains aren't developing because they're relying too much on Google Maps and these kind of software, and they don't have that navigational, but they're not building those navigational skills. Do you think it's just a few clicks away and they can just use AI to do it?
There's a culture thing. Like one generation are used to seeing the world like that. They then teach their kids that certain worldview, and that worldview passes down. I think in a sense, maybe there might not be a biological thing, but I think there could be a cultural ethics perspective that, yeah, your older generation influences the way you think, question things, and then we teach our kids just to take everything at face value. What kind of impact would that have on humanity?
Well, yeah. I can tell you now, I mean, most of the decisions we have to do in life, you need to use your emotions and also need to use your brain.
Mm.
You know what I mean? You have to, otherwise you would lose what it is being about being human, right? And I think that's every parent's responsibility at a country geo level. It's every leader's, and that's back to your point about, you know, countries. Some countries are going to make the wrong decisions with this, right? But it will change the course of history, I think. But we've still got 5-10 years ahead of us before it becomes like that, I think. But we're early, and it's, I guess, up to us and people like you who are trying to spread the truth. DJ and Aussie Apes, we're educating people. Because like you said, it's all about the usage of the technology. It's the crypto, blockchain, AI. What do we do with it all?
Actually, I like how you mentioned truth, because AI is, there's a lot of fake stuff now. And yeah, truth is more valuable. I think truth is now going to be a real commodity. I don't know what form it'll take on, but just continue to be genuine, continue to be real. I don't know what practical value comes out of that, but I think truth will be a very big theme in the next decade and century. Knowing what the truth is going to be taking a new meaning. Yeah,
I think we're just in a crazy time. We're in such an exciting time. What's right, what's wrong right now? You know, our parents didn't experience the level of learning, all these type of things, the social media. We're sort of just in a massive pond, just learning how to swim. So, I mean, I think we're going to see the right, we're going to see the wrong, we're going to see people exploit it. But at the end of the day, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Raymond, before we usually wrap up, man, we always love to ask about mental health.
Yeah.
Some tips on mental health. Us as traders, we've gone through a hard time. Now I'm hearing stories of everyone losing their jobs to AI. I mean, there's a lot of FUD, there's a lot of fear and negative sentiment in the world. What's some tips for mental health and just, you know, staying on top of your game and having that level of perseverance?
I like to approach mental health from more of a mindset perspective, mentality, how you see things in life. And I think that kind of solves many things in life. Knowing what is your standard of happiness. I think these days, social media, people can compare yourself to another. It can get, for some people, it can be very discouraging to see your life being behind your peers. But when in actual fact, you're actually doing okay. Just reflect on yourself and knowing what is happiness to you. Just living true to that principle. And that's easier said than done. That takes a lot of self-awareness and reflection. So that's a lifelong like journey. Like people discover what's true happiness till their 80s or something. So don't be too rushed to find that. Practicing gratitude and gratefulness, and just trying to do one random act of kindness per day. And it can be just small things. You don't have to be a billionaire charity to be considered someone who's charitable or philanthropist. You can just do the very small things, like help an elderly person pick up a piece of litter off the street, or help them, or just, you know, help your parents wash the dishes, or just check in on a friend. The small things, just they add up. It could be small to you, but it could mean the world to that other person. Like, you could potentially save someone from going down a destructive path just because you just sent them a 10-letter text saying how are you or something. I guess it's important to have direction and goals in life, but it's also very important to live by the day, to live presently, because you can have the grandest goals, you can achieve all you want in your life, but if you sacrifice your health, you burn all your relationships just to achieve that one goal, in the end, it might not be worth it in the end.
Unbalanced.
Yeah. And yeah, and also a third thing is, like, don't feel like it's bad to be different. The word difference is determined by relative standards. A person is considered different by a certain standard. But if you consider the totality of every attribute, every experience, there's no such thing as difference, just uniqueness. So you and I could be different in terms of, let's say, age, or you and I could be different in terms of your ethnicity. But if we consider the totality of life experiences, it's really just a factor of uniqueness. So in just embrace your unique self, have balance. I think tend to be happy no matter how long or life, or long or short their life is, and no matter what life throws at them.
What I took from everything you said is, if you're in a bad place or you're stuck in a rut, fix your mindset.
That's right.
Fix your mindset first, and everything else are practical examples you gave. Yeah,
that's right.
Nice.
Yeah, believe in yourself that you have value. The unfortunate cases where people gone down destructive routes is because they didn't believe that they were valuable to this world. I like to break it down to basic science. Like, you won the sperm race. You were granted life. So I'm not a super religious person nor spiritual person, but I do believe that if you're able to be born, especially in this time, like if you were born in ancient times where there was war, diseases, man, that's crazy. You're born in this time where you have access to health, electricity, AI, blockchain, making life so much easier, right? So, and imagine how long the earth has been around for, like, you know, hundreds or thousands or millions of years, and you're born in this small window of time, probably the best time to be alive in. That really motivates me just to, like, think, wow, I'm really lucky to be alive. I believe I was born for a certain purpose or value. You might not know what that purpose is, but as long as you do your best, keep helping people, eventually the value and purpose will come to you. And that's how I think it is.
Yeah, Such a positive mindset, honestly, man. We really love it. Thank you for that.
Should we drop these mics or what?
Honestly, super cool. I don't know what to say. I mean, I know all our guests will just be listening to this 2, 3, 4 times. They will be asking for you to come back, man, which we'd love to have you on again, and to AI more. But for everyone listening, I mean, you know, guys, you've been listening to Raymond Sun, lawyer, programmer, content creator, all things AI, K-pop. We're going to put up all the links. So make sure you follow, subscribe, and if you do need those legal issues, make sure you hit him up, guys.
That's right.
You've been listening to the Degen Aussie Apes, Wasi, Luca P, Sidorides.eth, and our fellow Degen, Raymond Sun. We'll catch you guys soon.
Thanks, lads. Thank you.
Thank you.